All rise. The Chief Judge and the Judges of the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals draw near, the court is now set. God save the United States and its honorable court.
Please be seated. Court is called to session. We're here for argument this morning in the case of United States v. Yarber, Article 62 appeal. Are both sides prepared to argue?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Very well. Government, you may begin.
Good morning, Chief Judge Roan, members of the court. May it please the court, I'm Captain Richard Schreider, and along with Colonel Don Christensen, I represent the United States in this matter. Your Honors, this Article 62 appeal is before this court because the military judge committed reversible error when he incorrectly concluded the government violated Article 46 of the UCMJ, RCM 703, and the Jenks Act, and because he compounded his error by taking the drastic measure of suppressing the victim's testimony in its entirety because her personal cell phone was lost prior to trial. While issuing his ruling, nearly every conclusion of law that the military judge articulated was either incorrect or a misapplication of the law. His decision cannot stand, and this court should reverse his faulty ruling and return this matter to the trial court so justice can be done.
Counsel, before you begin.
Yes, Your Honor.
I know Judge Weber's got some questions, but with respect to the standard of review that we're supposed to use in this case and the standard of review we give to the judge in his ruling.
Yes, Your Honor. The claims of improper loss or destruction of evidence should get a de novo review by this court. And as for the findings of fact, this court is bound by the military judge's findings of fact unless they are clearly erroneous.
What does that mean in this case? What are we reviewing de novo? What are we reviewing under a clearly erroneous standard? For example, what are the findings of fact that the judge made in this case?
Your Honor, the military judge did not issue a written ruling with a discrete findings of fact section or conclusions of law section. His ruling is on pages 266 to 274 of the record of trial. Most of what will be reviewed by this court would be de novo review because there much has to do with his conclusions of law. There were very limited findings of fact or factual issues that were at play here. But the military judge's actual concluding and drawing his conclusions from those facts is what's at issue here today.
So let me give you an example. The military judge, I think it's fair to say, found the government negligent in failing to secure the cell phone here. Is that a finding of fact or is that a conclusion of law?
Well, Your Honor, the actions taken by the investigators, those that he articulated, those would be findings of fact. But the legal conclusion that they were negligent would be a conclusion of law that should be getting de novo review.
What do you think are the findings of fact that the judge made here to get a clearly erroneous review?
Some findings of fact that would be coming into play through this, perhaps the fact that Sergeant Broadway did speak to Airman E.H., some of the factual matters that they discussed, the text messages, the fact that she wrote them down, and the content of those messages would be findings of facts that would be coming into play.
Is there an intermediate step in between clearly erroneous and de novo review in the judge's application of the facts to the law? For example, if we were to find that the judge's findings of fact were not clearly erroneous and that he stated the law correctly, but that he just misapplied the facts to the law, what standard do we look at in judging his application of the facts to the law?
If he's applying the facts to the law and his ultimate conclusion and ruling is based on an erroneous view of the law or a misapplication of the law, this court should be looking at whether his legal conclusions and his rulings were correct in law. And And that should be getting a de novo review.
Now, he said that, at some points he said various things, but with respect to the exculpatory value of the lost text, is that a finding of fact? Is that a conclusion?
I believe that would be a conclusion of law, Your Honor. The content of the text would be a factual matter, but the legal conclusion that it was exculpatory in nature and the extent of that would be a legal conclusion that he drew.
And is there anything in the record that where the military judge defines what exculpatory is and why it meets that test under the law?
No, Your Honor. He does not. He does discuss what he believed was exculpatory about it, and essentially it was the fact that the defense wanted to advance the theory of a mistake of fact as to consent. And that is what he determined to be somewhat exculpatory or to have some exculpatory value. But to be clear, that is the only text message or only aspect of anything that was contained on the phone that was articulated by the defense to have some exculpatory value was the final text message sent by Airman Yarber in which he said, I understand what you've said. Okay, I understand and I respect what you've said. I guess I just got the wrong idea. I'm more sorry right now than I have been in a while.
So would your argument or your position be that this court should make its own determination on whether the information is exculpatory and not rely on what the military judge may have determined?
That is correct, Your Honor. That is the government's position.
You mentioned that the only text that had any potential exculpatory value is the one you just quoted there. Now, the military judge seemed to place some weight on his determination or his surmising that there may be additional text messages out there. Did he find that there were additional text messages out there? Did he issue any findings of fact in regard to that?
No, Your Honor. And with regard to whether there were additional text messages out there, the military judge allowed the defense to sidestep the burden that they had of showing the exculpatory value of what was on that phone. It's the defense's burden to articulate what exactly is exculpatory about it. And Sergeant Broadway was available, and she testified at the Article 39A session about the content of the text messages and the steps she took to preserve the messages themselves. And there was no cross-examination about additional text messages or additional content to suggest that what she wrote down was incorrect or somehow selective in what she wrote down.
Are we allowed to?
Go ahead, sir. I was going to say, did Sergeant Broadway look at all the messages on the phone, or does she only look at what the alleged victim told her to look at?
And, Your Honor, her testimony was that she only looked at what Airman E.H. showed her on the phone. Sergeant Broadway did not take physical possession of the phone and scroll through it herself. What she testified to was that Airman E.H. held the phone. She directed her to show her all text messages involving Airman Yarber, and that's what Airman E.H. Purportedly did. She asked if there were any additional text messages, and Airman E.H. said no. So it can be presumed, I think, fairly by this court that Sergeant Broadway did see all the text messages at issue.
Well, is it the government's position then that Tech Sergeant Broadway?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is it your position then that Tech Sergeant did due diligence by only looking at what the victim said to look at?
Well, yes, Your Honor.
You don't think that Tech Sergeant should have looked at more?
Well, Your Honor, I think there's a difference.
About the context of the whole thing.
I do think there's a difference between perhaps best practice and ideal investigatory steps and due diligence and doing what kind of a minimum requirement type standard. But Sergeant Broadway asked whether there was anything else on the phone, and Airman E.H. said there wasn't. Sergeant Broadway then took the steps of calling her boss to see if she should take the phone into evidence. And he said, no, not at this time. And that is when Sergeant Broadway took the additional step of preserving that evidence by writing down verbatim what the content of those messages were. And that final message, in fact, the reason why the defense even knew about the content of this message and had the theory of whether this was exculpatory or not was because Sergeant Broadway took that additional step of preserving the evidence.
Well, if she was really into preserving the evidence, shouldn't Tech Sergeant Broadway have taken the phone? Seized the phone?
Well, and Your Honor, I think that's a bit trickier question than it may sound at first blush. This was Airman E.H.'s personal private cell phone. So if Sergeant Broadway wanted that phone, she could have asked her for it, obviously, and it could have been handed over consent, sure. But if Airman EH had said, no, I want to maintain my phone, then the government would have, and investigators would have different hurdles they'd have to jump through in order to seize that phone.
It's evidence of a potential crime. Why is that unusual as far as evidentiary collection that all police officers go through? Why is that unusual?
And I think it would be fair if the investigators wanted to seize that phone that they could perhaps have gone and gotten probable cause search authorization to or some valid legal right to seize the phone other than simply just taking the phone.
What would the analysis be, assuming that the victim in this case had said, there were other emails, but I don't know what they were, I don't recall?
Yes, sir.
Then I'm looking at, okay, so I think one of the defense's arguments would likely be, we don't know what we don't know. There could have been other information in there of an exculpatory nature or used for cross-examination to impeach the witness. So isn't that part of the analysis the judge should be taking into account, that under Article 46, the right to evidence has been waylaid by the government's failure to collect obvious evidence in this case, and they can't pursue the case that they'd like to pursue?
Yes, Your Honor, and the defense position of, well, we don't know what was on it because it's gone, that's not good enough on a lost evidence or destroyed evidence analysis. Because what has to be shown is the, going back to U.S. v. Trombetta, that's 467 U.S. 479, and then Arizona v. Youngblood 488 U.S. 51. The evidence must possess exculpatory value that is apparent before it's lost and destroyed. It must be of such a nature that the defendant would be unable to obtain comparable evidence by any other reasonably available means. And then the court added the bad faith requirement, which is that the accused must show the government lost or destroyed the evidence in bad faith. And as the court in U.S. v. Kern, Court of Military Appeals case 22 MJ 49 talked about, the burden of articulating the exculpatory nature of in this case, the phone, would be on the accused. And the only avenue or the only aspect of the phone that they were able to articulate of having some type of potentially useful value to the defense was that final text message itself. And so anything else that is out there or that might have been on the phone, the defense did not articulate an exculpatory value to any of that.
Right, and that one text message, which could support a mistake of fact as to consent defense, why doesn't that rise to the level of exculpatory evidence under that first prong of the due process Article 46 analysis?
Yes, Your Honor, and with regard to the exculpatory value, it has to be apparently exculpatory. And in this case, it's pretty clear from, if you look at Sergeant Broadway's testimony in its entirety and Officer Denias, his testimony in its entirety, the value that was seen on with regard to this phone and the text messages was inculpatory value. And as the court in U.S. v. Kern talked about, just broadly speaking, evidence can be placed in two categories, exculpatory or inculpatory. Inculpatory, of course, being more favorable to the government. And taken into context, that series of text messages between Airman Yarber and Airman EH, it's fairly characterized as an acknowledgement of wrongfulness on the behalf of Airman Yarber. The only statement that Airman EH says is that she's a quality woman and won't be treated like something cheap.
Recognizing that it might have more inculpatory value than exculpatory, how exculpatory does it have to be for this due process analysis to be triggered?
Well, and it's even if you assume that if you buy into Airman Yarber's defense that maybe this rises to a mistake of fact, the I got the wrong idea text message, if that meets the exculpatory value in this court's eyes, the analysis still fails under prongs 2 and 3 of the
understand the remaining prongs. My question is, how exculpatory does it have to be?
Well, with regard to, I think the materiality question comes into play. If it is exculpatory to a material issue, whether he's guilty or innocent, for example, if the text message may have said, you know I didn't touch you, I was in Iowa that weekend, maybe I think that would certainly rise to a level of being exculpatory because it provides an alibi. Or
it actually gets to the issue of guilt or innocence. Whereas here, it's a bit more, I think it's more transparent, and it definitely does not have the luster of being exculpatory in nature, because he's acknowledging and admitting to touching her, at least inappropriately in some respect. So I think it's not necessarily a bright-line rule on whether or not, if it meets exculpatory value, you know, up to a certain point. But I think taken into context, it's clear that on the whole, that this phone and the messages contained therein were inculpatory.
Let me see if I understand the government's position here. Is the government's position that exculpatory equates to materiality? It has to be material on essentially an ultimate issue in the trial?
Not necessarily. Exculpatory could be favorable to the defense. And here, obviously, I would concede that if the message advances a defense or allows the defense to put on an affirmative defense, such as mistake of fact, it would have some favorableness to the defense and could be considered exculpatory.
Okay. Let me go to your bad faith prong on that.
Yes, sir.
What's your definition of bad faith under the law? And specifically in answering that, address the defense's argument that, as they put it, gross negligence may also apply in the bad faith arena.
Yes, Your Honor. And to be clear, there has been no, this court or our superior courts have not held in a context of loss evidence that gross negligence is enough. That the rule set forth in Arizona v. Youngblood is that there has to be bad faith. And in Arizona v. Youngblood, the court discusses kind of some examples of what they might think of, but it's an official animus towards the accused or some kind of attempt to essentially hamper the defense with an issue that is material to the case. And that would go back to the guilt or innocence aspect of the exculpatory nature of the phone. And Arizona v. Youngblood, the court said negligence is not enough to satisfy bad faith. They also discussed that the government failure to use a particular investigative tool is not good enough to satisfy a due process violation. In U.S. v. Blaney, this court held that poor judgment or even ineptitude does not equal bad faith. U.S. v. Terry, 66 MJ514, that's where some hospital surveillance photographs went missing as well as some physical items. Despite there might have been not some negligence or perhaps not best practice, again, no bad faith. So the government's position is that for bad faith to be present, you actually have to have a conscious effort towards doing something. You can't accidentally do something on purpose. The government's position is that there has to be some level of conscious effort on behalf of a government actor for there to be bad faith, such as putting somebody on the stand that they know is going to be lying, or something of that nature, deliberately covering up or losing evidence which might show the innocence of an accused.
So lack of due diligence doesn't apply. That's not enough?
I do not believe so, no, Your Honor, because lack of due diligence would be in line with what the Youngblood Court talked about and not potentially using all investigative tools. But as I said, even in U.S. v. Blaney, this court held that bad judgment or poor or even ineptitude does not equal bad faith.
So it doesn't matter how inept the investigators are?
No, and in fact, looking at Arizona v. Youngblood, the concurring opinion of Justice Stevens, he does not fall in line with, even though he agrees in the result, he says that he sort of starts talking about a negligence standard or something less than a bright line standard or bad faith standard where if the issue was of critical importance, he might be able to foresee an issue. And the court did not take that stance in Illinois v. Fisher when Justice Stevens was again left trying to concur with that kind of a less than bad faith conscious effort standard.
But in Arizona v. Youngblood and Illinois v. Fisher, the majority in both cases held that a bad faith showing was not required if it was materially exculpatory evidence as opposed to potentially useful evidence. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. The The court still stands by in Illinois v. Fisher the bad faith standard, though. And they've never gone back and said negligence is good enough, or gross indifference even. They say bad faith means bad faith. And in this case, at worst, it's a poor judgment on behalf of an investigator to not utilize all investigative tools. But to show the absence of bad faith here, Sergeant Broadway's actions should be taken into account. If Sergeant Broadway wanted to cover up clearly exculpatory evidence, so even if we think that the last text message is so exculpatory that everybody should have known about the exculpatory nature of the text messages, Sergeant Broadway took the step of writing it down. If somebody wants to get rid of something or is acting in bad faith towards the accused, she wouldn't have written it down. And she certainly wouldn't have told Airman E.H., don't delete the messages. We might need these in the future. Somebody might need to look at them. That shows the absence of bad faith. That shows good faith effort on behalf of the investigators in this case.
Even if we don't find in a violation of Article 46, does that preclude keeping the evidence out under RCM 703 or a Jenks Act violation?
Well, no, those are separate analysis, Your Honor. However, the military judge was incorrect when he was analyzing this case under the RCM 703 analysis, too. He incorrectly concluded that the evidence was of central importance and necessary for a fair trial.
Whose call is that?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Whose call is that? Is of central importance? Is that not the military judge's determination on whether that evidence meets that test? Are we supposed to do our own analysis with respect to that determination, or do we defer to him?
Well, the defense does not have to show bad faith under a 703 analysis, but the defense does have to show the central importance of the issue. And here the defense did not meet that burden, so the military judge's conclusion and finding fact, actually, in that respect, were both wrong. The phone itself is of very limited, if any, value to this case. The content of the messages, perhaps, is more important and of some importance to this trial.
But so the determination that it was of central importance as to be necessary to ensure a fair trial, is that a finding of fact or a conclusion of law?
I believe that's a conclusion of law, Your Honor. Even if you buy the accused's argument that the mistake of fact is raised through this final text message, the content is what's important. The content of that message is what's important to this trial, and it provides the accused the opportunity to advance his theory of the case. And that information is available. That information was handed over to the defense, and that information has been preserved by Sergeant Broadway. She's able to testify about it. Her notes survive, and Airman E.H. also would be able to presumably discuss anything that the defense may want to go down in that regard. Military judge in analyzing RCM 703 also let the accused off the hook when he decided that there was nothing more the accused could have done to preserve the phone. What was discussed in the Article 39A session and attached to the defense motion, which is Appellate Exhibit 8 in the record, is basically a boilerplate defense discovery request where they ask for all Jenks Act material. And there was no specific preservation request for Airman E.H.'s telephone. There was no specific discovery request for messages between specific phone numbers or Airman E.H. and other phone numbers, including the accused. So there was additional steps that that the accused could have taken to preserve the phone. And the military judge was incorrect when he allowed the defense to sidestep that burden as well.
Well, can you respond to the defense position that when you're talking about comparable evidence, that it's not fair, or that the defense shouldn't have to rely on the handwritten notes of a government agent?
I think it's important to consider Sergeant Broadway's testimony when thinking about that point specifically, that argument by the defense. Sergeant Broadway was available for cross-examination, and the defense cross-examined her and never once raised an issue of additional content or cross-examined her to suggest that what she wrote down was incorrect. So I think it is fair to characterize the evidence that Sergeant Broadway preserved and wrote down as being an accurate depiction of what was on that telephone. The messages, there was no cross-examination about something else missing or something being incorrect about those text messages. So to be unfair to the defense to have to rely on that, I think that's that's a not a colorable argument.
Counsel, I know you're going to be running out of time here pretty quick. Let's get to the Jenks Act for a moment. One, was this a statement that qualifies under the Jenks Act? And then two, if you would also discuss your assertion there that it's not a violation of the Jenks Act if it is a statement because it wasn't made to police officers in the course of an investigation. Because I want to know where you get that second part under the case law.
Yes, Your Honor. I think it's worth pointing out that factually, this information is this text message exchange occurred between Airman E.H. and Airman Yarber before any government actor came into play. She was responding to text messages sent by Airman Yarber on her personal cell phone. There was no officiality of this statement. There was no eye or that it was prepared with an eye towards handing it into investigators or that she was acting as an agent or doing this at the suggestion of an agent of the government.
Does there have to be, is my question under the Jenks Act. Is there case law that supports that concept that it has to be to an investigator before it's protected under Jenks Act material?
Well, under the Jenks Act, it simply has to relate to the same subject matter. But there is some, I think it would be fair to say that the it does not have to be prepared at the suggestion of the government. So I will not say that that's a requirement. However, the information, the statement was handed over. So even under any Jenks Act analysis or RCM 914, the statement was handed over to the defense. They have the information and it was available to them. There was no Jenks Act violation. And furthermore, the military judge was incorrect in that it was not in the possession, custody, or control of the government actor. And I see that I'm out of time, Your Honor. If I may briefly conclude?
Yeah, and you're going to reserve 5 minutes, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Go ahead.
Your Honor, the military judge was absolutely incorrect when he found violations of Article 46, RCM 703, and the Jenks Act. There was no evidence whatsoever that the government or a government actor acted in bad faith or that they were attempting to hamper the defense in any way, shape, or form. This court should reverse the military judge's highly erroneous decision to silence Airman E.H. and return this matter to trial.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Agent Royan.
Chief Judge Roan, Senior Judge Helgett, Judge Weber, good morning, and may it please the Court. I'm Major Zobin Saroyan, and I, along with Lieutenant Colonel Jane Bloomer, represent the appellee in this case, A1C Dex Yarber. Your Honors, the government has spent a great deal of time, both at here and on brief, arguing that the military judge got it wrong. In fact, at least here today, I counted five times that they said that the military judge got it wrong. It is worth highlighting that the standard here is not whether or not this court agrees with the military judge or whether it would have ruled the same way as the judge, but instead whether the judge's rulings are fairly supported by the record. Now, I know Your Honors have read the briefs, and so I won't take the court's time simply reciting those back to you. I would like to take the opportunity to discuss some specific points for the court's consideration.
Well, before you do that, let me ask, because we don't have traditional findings of fact or conclusions of law within this particular record. Typically, that's what we get, so we can rely on that to determine whether they're clearly erroneous or arbitrary.
Yes.
We don't have that, so what are we supposed to do? Because it doesn't look like there was a lot of evidence put on during the motions hearing to make these findings of fact, much less the conclusions of law. So how are we supposed to give him deference?
Appellee would agree that there could have been a better job in the findings of fact and conclusions of law. That simply is what it is. To that extent, though, this court can rely on the record to see whether or not it fairly supports those ultimate conclusions, findings of fact and conclusions of law. So to that extent, there certainly is enough evidence to make those rulings.
Now, it seems like two different standards of review are being advanced here. Both have supported case law from CAF. CAF has repeatedly stated that in an Article 62 appeal, particularly where we don't have fact-finding authority, our role is limited to two questions. Were the military judge's findings of fact clearly erroneous, and were his conclusions of law supported under a de novo review? And those two questions play in the ultimate issue of whether the military judge abused his discretion. Do you agree that it's not a finding of fact, then it's a conclusion of law, and essentially we're looking at this under a de novo standard? And if not, how do you square that with the fact that CAF has repeatedly broken the abuse of discretion standard down into those two components?
If I understand Your Honor's question correctly, let me ask this. So is Your Honor asking, if we don't have a finding of fact, what do we do with that?
That is my question. Are we limited to two pure questions? Finding the fact clearly erroneous, conclusion of law, de novo review? Or is there some middle ground where we, as you suggest, have more of a traditional abuse of discretion standard where we look at, you know, are the application of the facts to the law within that realm of discretion?
Appellee would argue that the findings of fact and the conclusions of law are sort of the tactical level, or the ground level, whereas whether or not the entire entire holding is fairly supported by the record. That's more of the 30,000 foot view. So to the extent that there's a middle ground, I think it would have to go to the 30,000 foot level. You know, by and large, is this supported by the record? Is there a reasonable inference that can be given to these conclusions of all these findings of fact? And to that extent, I think they all work together. Now, there are some issues with the government's argument. And again, as Your Honor has correctly pointed out, we've got three tests here, right? So we have RCM 703, we have the Jenks Act, we have Article 46. The problem is that the government treats those tests as squishy. By way of example, I would direct the court's attention to the government's record at 24 and 25. In just those two pages, the government either asserts or implies that, for example, the Jenks Act requires prejudice. It does not. They discuss that the evidence needs to be of central importance under the Jenks Act. It does not. And they imply, though I think they corrected that here today, that bad faith is an issue under the Jenks Act. They certainly corrected that as to 703. But that is also untrue. And so let's go into that in a little bit more detail. First, under the Jenks Act, prejudice, and this is also under RCM 914, the Jenks Act does not require a showing of prejudice at the trial level, period. That is supported by United States v. Patterson at 10 MJ 599, that's at 601. That's also supported by United States v. Albo, that's at 46 CMR 30 at 35.
Well, let's go to the beginning of this. Why is the Jenks Act implicated in this case? How does it meet the definition of 914F, that it's a written statement made by the witness that is signed or otherwise adopted or approved by the witness? So how was that requirement met in this case? How was it signed or adopted by Airman EH?
It certainly could not be argued to be an erroneous or... When someone sends a text message, it's to convey information. When they hit send, they intend to convey that information.
But isn't it signed or adopted to the testimony that she would give at trial and not just some statement given at some other time?
No, I believe it is also, the Act requires that it is also approved. And that's the key language. And in this case, when you're sending a text message to someone, you are inherently approving what it is you're sending.
But the content of those text messages, at least as relayed by Sergeant Broadway, had nothing to do with the actual event that occurred, the facts and circumstances surrounding what had happened prior to that. This was basically comments of, you shouldn't have done this, I'm a class lady, however she phrased it. But it had nothing to do with the facts and circumstances relating to the alleged assault. So how is she adopting those statements within the context of her testimony?
Well, under the Jenks Act, Your Honor, the only thing that needs to occur is that the text messages in this case need to relate to her testimony. That's the extent of the requirement. And again, there's no requirement that these text messages be of central importance. Indeed, in Jenks v. United States, which was the predecessor to the Jenks Act, the Supreme Court said, quote, because the only defense, only the defense, is adequately equipped to determine the effective use of the evidence for purposes of discrediting the government witness, and thereby furthering the accused's defense, the defense must initially be entitled to see them to determine what use may be used of them. Justice, the Supreme Court said, requires no less.
So you have those statements, or at least as relayed by Sergeant Broadway. How are you discrediting the witness in this case with those statements? How could you do that? Is what
well, and that goes even further, Your Honor. So the Supreme Court in Jenks and in Palermo v. United States and in Albo all hold that the evidence doesn't even need to be useful to qualify under the Jenks Act. It must simply relate to the witness's testimony. And I saw Your Honor's reaction, and I understand that, right? So on appeal, we're sort of all trained to look for prejudice. You know, the final question is, what does it matter? Under the Jenks Act, it doesn't have to matter. It simply does not have to matter. All that it has to be is related to the testimony of the witness, and we clearly have that here.
Now, is that related to the testimony? You pull that from case law again. I'm looking at 914F, signed, adopted, or approved. Where does it say it's related to the testimony? And if you've got case law, great. I'm just asking what the rule says. You've kind of expanded that to say what you did, related to.
So if Your Honor looks at 914 under, I believe it's F3, it states that the military judge shall order the party who called the witness to produce for examination and use by the moving party any statement of the witness which relates to the subject matter concerning which the witness has testified. So it simply has to relate to a matter to which they have testified. And clearly we have that here.
Wouldn't it mean, though, that any time evidence is lost, a statement of a prior statement that conceivably is related to the testimony, if it's lost somehow, bad faith or otherwise, that you would have an automatic Jenks violation?
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you have case law to support that notion, and is there a requirement that her testimony then be prohibited, no matter how or how lack of relevance it might have to her testimony at trial? It would seem like what you're arguing is that any violation of the Jenks Act requires that she be prohibited from taking the stand. Is that the ultimate result that you're advocating right now?
Your Honor asked two questions, so I'll take those in order. First, the case law that speaks to that is Jenks, Palermo, Albo, and Patterson. And so, to that extent, there is substantial case law which says that if there's a violation, it is an automatic violation. Again, all of these other factors that are sort of weaved into the government's argument, and again, they're sort of being treated as squishy. It makes sense. We normally deal with these requirements, and so they're somewhat inherent in our analysis. But this court should be very careful in that those requirements are not in the Jenks Act. And so as to the question as to whether or not the Jenks Act requires the exclusion, the Jenks Act requires the exclusion if there is bad faith or gross negligence. It does not require the exclusion in the absence of bad faith or gross negligence, but it is still a remedy. I would direct this court to United States v. Marsh. That's 21 MJ 445 at 447, and there it's citing United States v. Jackson, which is a D.C. Circuit opinion from 1982. That's 450 A2D 419 at 427. And I'll quote, "A violation of the government's duty resulting in the loss of producible statements does not automatically require the imposition of sanctions provided for in the Jenks Act. A trial court must examine the, quote, totality of the circumstances in determining what sanctions to apply. The degree of negligence involved is especially significant to a determination of an appropriate sanction. Where the loss is a result of bad faith or gross negligence, the trial court must exclude the witness's testimony."
So going to that argument, would you have gross negligence or bad faith in this case?
Here we have substantial gross negligence. And frankly, it amounts to bad faith. And as this, as Your Honor correctly noted in our supplemental filing, this court, this court's predecessor, the Air Force Board of Review, has held that gross indifference can rise to the level of bad faith. Here we have, I'll back up a little bit. So when the questions were made to government earlier, there was some discussion of the bad faith as to just the investigators. The problem here is that it's not just the investigators, it's also the prosecution, it's also the legal office in this particular case. So I won't recite what happened with regard to Tech Sergeant Broadway, except to say she herself was terribly concerned with her supervision's denial of her request to collect the evidence. Indeed, the military judge during the motions hearing said, listen, in your 14 years of doing this, have you ever heard of this happening before? And her answer was, no. So she clearly knew this evidence should have been collected. And despite the fact that her first-line supervisor said, eh, don't worry about it, there's no evidence that she raised it higher, which would have been her duty to do. So that there is some problem there. What's more problematic is that her first-line supervisor, who testified at the motions hearing, could provide no plausible explanation as to why he decided to order her not to collect the evidence. So on cross-examination, he said, well, I didn't want to mess up the evidence. He's an investigator, but we just wanted to leave the evidence alone. And on cross-examination, he was asked, well, how could you have messed up the evidence? Well, we really couldn't have. Well, wasn't it a bigger problem to not collect the evidence? Yeah, that was the bigger problem. So even knowing this, he still ordered Tech Sergeant Broadway to not collect the evidence. That's, at a minimum, gross indifference.
Let me direct you back to, we skipped over a foundational step in the Jenks Act analysis, which is that the statements must be in the possession of the United States. When did the United States take possession of the text messages?
The United States took possession of those text messages when they made an order to Senior Airman ELH, in this case, to preserve that evidence. In other words, what they did is they delegated by order their obligations under the AFMANs and under AFIs to preserve that evidence. And let's be very clear about this. Tech Sergeant Broadway, I should say, was very clear that she expected that order to be followed. There is nothing in the record to indicate that Senior Airman ELH had any authority to disobey that order. So everything in the record indicates that she was obligated on behalf of the United States Air Force to preserve that evidence.
She may have had a duty to preserve it, but in what sense, in the common understanding of the word possession, did the United States possess that phone?
Your Honor, she became an agent of the United States at that point in preserving that information. By that delegation, she became, one, authorized to preserve that evidence and obligated to.
Is that because she's a military member, or is that because, would that apply to any government agent telling or investigator telling a civilian in the world to protect?
I think it's because she was a military member, an Air Force member, that she was obligated under the order that was given by Tech Sergeant Broadway. So I suppose that's part a two-part answer. She was obligated, and at that point, she became an agent of the United States.
So is your position then that she could be receive punitive action for her dereliction in duty?
Yes, Your Honor.
If we accept the notion that the Jenks Act applies, what messages is the defense entitled to in this case?
The defense would have been entitled, again, they're lost, and as the government conceded at trial, there's no way to replace those text messages. But they would have been entitled to all of the messages that relate to Senior Airman ELH.
I thought the Jenks Act only applied to statements of the witness. So you're saying that the text messages from the accused in this case would be required to be turned over under the Jenks Act, or only the text messages of Airman EH?
It would be the text messages as they relate to her testimony, Your Honor. Thinking of text messages, they tend to go back and forth, and so as a stream goes,
You haven't addressed why you don't have those with Sergeant Broadway's recitation of what she saw on the phone. Well, why don't you have her statements?
And that makes sense, Your Honor, and that goes back to sort of the squishy treatment that the government has given it. That there are or is comparable evidence is not a factor under the Jenks Act. I would also back up and say there's no evidence that he has those. We do know for a fact that the yellow rope in this case, it was A1C Williams, deleted some information. It appears it may have just been contact information. I don't know that that was entirely clear, but to the extent that messages sometimes don't go through, we don't know that he received all of the messages. There's simply no evidence in the record to support or counter that.
But you're arguing an evidentiary issue, the loss of evidence. We're asking about Jenks Act. You have a statement that Sergeant Broadway says, this is what I saw, substantially or essentially verbatim, with the exception of changing one word, I guess, to say she. So don't you have the statements? Not whether the other evidence is lost for Article 46 purposes, but for Jenks Act, you have her statements, do you not?
It's sort of a multi-layered answer, so if I might have some leave. First, Judge Hugget, as you pointed out, context matters, right? Here we don't have the context. We have, the only thing that we have is what was shown to Tech Sergeant Broadway. Again, there's no way Tech Sergeant Broadway can say, I saw all the messages. In fact, point, she said, I only wrote down what I was shown. I never took possession. And this is very important, one of the last questions the military judge asked her is, did you ever make an independent analysis as to the breadth of that evidence? Answer, no. So we don't know what evidence was seen, not seen. We don't know the breadth of it. So we certainly don't have the context of it.
We do know that Airman EH repeatedly stated that she only sent one text message and that the accused sent three to her. She said that in her statement the night of the incident. She said that in the Article 32 testimony. We also know, and I recognize we don't have fact-finding authority, but that at most 5 hours passed in between the time of the incident and the time she wrote that statement that night, the time that Sergeant Broadway looked at the phone. We know that Airman EDH was doing a number of other things during that time that would have kept her occupied. We can read the text messages themselves, which seem to indicate a finality to them. Other than pure speculation and the fact that Sergeant Broadway indicated she relied on EH, do we have any reason to believe that what Sergeant Broadway wrote down isn't essentially the sum and substance of the text messages?
Your Honor's question, and I do get this, parses between comparable evidence and prejudice. Those aren't factors. Those are not factors under the Jenks analysis.
But as Chief Judge Rohn pointed out, what the accused is entitled to under the Jenks Act are the statements, not necessarily phone, the electrons, the forensic analysis of the phone. It's the statements.
Yes, sir.
And the statements, that can be in any form, can it?
No, Your Honor, it can't be in any form. To say that it can be available in any form is to say that comparable evidence is looked at under the Jenks Act analysis, and it's simply not. The government attempts to sort of muddle this in their, and this, again, this is at 24 and 25, where they say, listen, Marsh, Panna, and Myers all suggest that as long as there's, this comparable evidence available, that we're good to go, and that's simply not the case. Here, there is no requirement of comparable evidence, and a review of those particular cases shows that, first, it's reviewing, it's an Article 66, Article 67 appeal, so it's looking backwards. And again, at trial, there's no requirement for a showing of prejudice, and maybe a little background is warranted. So under the Jenks Act, there's no requirement of prejudice at trial. The only time prejudice is looked at is when it comes up on an Article 66 appeal or an Article 67 appeal, and the defense was denied its motion. And so on appeal, we're looking back and saying, okay, was that denial problematic? Was there any prejudice? But as to where we are now at trial, there's absolutely no requirement that that be shown. And so that there is or is not comparable evidence is simply not looked at. And even if it were looked at, we have a couple of problems here. So Your Honor said, listen, we have the testimony of Senior Airman ELH. Well, if you look at the, even if you look at the cases cited by the government, again, Myers, Marsh, and Pena, all three of those cases discuss the overwhelming evidence. There was affirmative, compelling evidence that the statements were the same. We don't have that here. In none of those cases was there a complaining witness at issue. Here we have that. Here we have a complaining witness and a complaining witness who has a somewhat substantial motive to lie about her maybe leading on appellee because she was married. So to suggest that in that circumstance she's going to testify that, yeah, I probably gave him a reasonable mistake to believe that I was interested in him is probably not going to happen. And so to that extent, to call that testimony comparable with the text messages, which now can't be retrieved, it belies logic. So those are clearly not similar. As to Tech Sergeant Broadway, even if we accept the premise that she was 98% correct in what she wrote down, we don't know that she wasn't 98% correct about 10% of the information. So to suggest that that is somehow compelling affirmative evidence that they're comparable, again, belies logic. It simply doesn't make sense. The other thing that we have to look at is Tech Sergeant Broadway is an investigator. She's now having to testify that after 14 years of being a security forces officer, after 14 years of being a security forces officer, she didn't secure evidence. It's probably in her best interest to say, but what I did write down, I wrote down really, really well.
Whose burden is it at trial to demonstrate that there are statements within the meaning of the Jenks Act?
Well, it would be the appellee's burden to show that there are statements. But here, the trial judge found that there were statements, and that's clearly not erroneous, given the entire record.
Let me shift your burden. As you discussed the Jenks Act, because you're running out of time, let's talk about Article 46 and 703. With respect to Article 46, how is this what we do have available to look at? How are those statements exculpatory? Because that's what the military judge found. They were potentially exculpatory. They were potential defense, a mistake of fact. So how did you come up with that conclusion?
If I might have just a moment, Your Honor. I would direct this court's attention to United States v. Kern at 22 MJ 49 at 50. It defines exculpatory. And that's a CMA case from 1986. Evidence which tends to prove the existence of a favorable fact to the accused. That's it. That's all that's required.
What is that potential favorable fact?
As the judge correctly held, that favorable fact is that there is at least an indication of a mistake of fact defense.
How are you going to get that in if the government doesn't use those texts? In other words, if the government chose not to pursue that line of questioning as to what the accused may have said after the fact, mm-hmm. How are you going to get that in to begin with? Well, it's a hearsay statement, so how is it that the defense thinks it's going to be able to take that evidence and use it as a potential defense in the first place?
Cross-examination of ELH?
With respect to what he said?
It's a statement.
Well, that's not the standard. I mean, it would be a hearsay statement,
well,
I'm sure, objective.
No, you're correct, Your Honor. I apologize. So I guess I'm sort of stepping back a little bit. Under that analysis, it wouldn't have to be something that they ultimately introduce. It's just their ability to examine whether or not the defense exists. And here the evidence is exculpatory. There's no requirement that they ultimately use the evidence.
Okay, without getting too far, I'm just wondering how that evidence is going to be raised based on that statement, that one-line statement in those texts from the defense himself. How are you going to get that into evidence? Because that goes to the question about the central importance under 703. How important is this evidence to begin with? And I'm just wondering how it really raises the possibility of an affirmative defense in this case if the government chooses not to go down that line of using those texts.
Well, it always remains a possibility that the appellant himself testifies.
Sure.
Or, excuse me, the appellee.
Okay. And that's always his choice, so that's how you could get it in. But I'm just looking at the lost statements, the value of those lost statements to the defense's case. Because that's one of the things under 703 that has to be of central importance to an issue that is essential to a fair trial.
Well, how is that essential? Yes, Your Honor. And if I might have just a brief second, because what I hear, Your Honor, you're sort of moving back and forth between RCM 703 and Article 46.
Correct. I am intermingling.
So to that extent, if you'll bear with me for just one second. Okay, so I don't see how that would be applicable under Article 46. Again, that all that needs to be is that the evidence is exculpatory, not that, theoretically, if it's exculpatory, it's of central importance, and we've met that element. So I'm not sure that Your Honor's question goes to the ultimate analysis. As to the central importance at issue, I'll admit I'm a little stuck on how that ultimately is going to come in, and I apologize for that since I'm not prepping up the trial from that position. I am fairly confident that would ultimately come in. And to that extent, to say that exculpatory evidence is not of central importance, again, that doesn't seem consistent to appellee.
Is it your position that the photos on the cell phone had any exculpatory value? The military judge at least mentioned the photos in his analysis.
To the extent, and again, Senior Judge Hulbert, I think this goes back to what you're saying, to the extent that it provides context, absolutely. So, you know, as an example, if they're sitting at the table in the DFAC, and we know that one of the photos that she showed was of her throwing knives, if she's throwing knives in a bikini, that's going to be a very different matter than if it is a professional production and she's at Cirque du Soleil. So the context of these photographs could very well inform the overall tenor of the mistake of fact defense.
Whose burden is the trial to demonstrate that they were, under 703, that they were of central importance to the trial, or under Article 46, that they had exculpatory value?
Well, I think under 46, as to the exculpatory value, it's, to answer Your Honor's question, it would be the appellee's burden.
Did the appellee put on any evidence to demonstrate what these photos might have demonstrated, that they might have been relevant in providing context?
And I think the question to Your Honor's question, but I think if we step back and we ask if this is fairly supported by the record, the answer is yes, right? So clearly he had a mistake of fact defense. I may have gotten the wrong idea. Why? Why did he get the wrong idea? That brings in the context of the remaining text messages as well as the photograph. And, Your Honor, I see that I'm out of time, if I might briefly conclude.
I have one question before we do that. I'd just like to cover, because we didn't cover this at all, even if there is, let's say, exculpatory evidence and there's no comparable evidence, let's say we agree with you on that. When you're looking at the remedy here, you point out the Kern case. Kern talks about, you know, maybe requiring the government to stipulate as to the facts and circumstances. The government has to exclude, maybe the remedy would be excluding the inculpatory evidence that was on those text messages. Wouldn't that be a more appropriate remedy than what was given in this case?
I would go back, Your Honor, to the judge's discretion, and this court's role here is to ask whether or not the decision was fairly supported. Under the Jenks Act specifically, in addition to the others, but more to the Jenks Act, the military judge has wide discretion. Again, I would direct this court's attention to United States v. Jackson for that premise, and that's cited by Marsh, which is a CMA case. Only when there is gross negligence or bad faith is the judge required to suppress the evidence. All of those other statements, you know, you can you can remove the inculpatory evidence, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. At the end of that block, the court says, and only when there's bad faith must you set aside the charges. If you go to the beginning of the quote, it says, suppress the inculpatory evidence. That would be her testimony. And read in context, what they're saying is, that's within the judge's discretion. And that is not one of the most, contrary to what the government argues, that is not the most, the harshest result. The harshest result is to simply set aside the charge. The judge didn't do that here. The government is still free to come forward on those charges. They still have the statements from A1C Kabuki, who was sitting right across from them and yet appears to have seen nothing. You still have the statements of the yellow vote, who was there when all this was apparently going wrong and walked up and apparently saw nothing and was not told anything. They still have witnesses they can bring if they so choose, if they think they can prevail with those witnesses. The charge hasn't been set aside, just the inculpatory evidence, which was well within the judge's discretion, Your Honor.
Thanks.
Go ahead.
Conclude, please.
Your Honors, the issue is not whether this court agrees with the military judge or would have itself ruled the very same way. The only issue is whether the military judge's findings are fairly supported by the record, and here they are. Accordingly, this court should affirm the military judge's rulings.
Thank you. Thank you. Well,
Your Honor, just briefly with respect to Article 46 and RCM 703 analysis, the government's position is that the military judge erred in concluding that there were violations of both because at the very least there was comparable evidence available. And just briefly to address the Jenks Act discussion, the government's position is that this was not, the text message was not a statement within the definition of the Jenks Act or RCM 914. But even if you believe that it was a statement, there was only one text message that can fall within the Jenks Act, and that's the third text message, the response from Airman EH herself. And that very limited text message is the only thing that could even arguably be considered a statement because those are her words, and those are words that can be fairly characterized and attributed to her. And the Jenks Act cases do discuss that, including the Palermo case that the defense cited to, appellee's counsel cited to previously.
If there was a violation of the Jenks Act, did the military judge abuse his discretion in throwing out the Airman EH's testimony?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that his, well, he can, he has discretion and he could have eliminated the witness's testimony. So I think that if there's a Jenks Act violation, yes, the military judge can take that measure. But I think it's an indicator of how far off the mark he was that he did not consider or did not appear to consider any of the other lesser forms of remedy that could have existed. As this court noted, it could have limited the testimony, could have prevented discussion about the text messages, or he could have done what one of the defense propositions was, which was to provide an instruction to the members beforehand. And the defense even proposed a lost evidence type instruction. And the fact that the military judge failed to utilize any of those options, I think, is an indicator of how far off the mark he was when reaching his incorrect conclusion. But just the final point with regard to the Jenks Act, this information was not within the custody or control of the United States government. If you follow appellee's faulty reasoning all the way to its logical conclusion, no witness would ever be able to testify at a trial if they sent a text message to their mother that said, Mom, something happened to me last night. And then that phone or that text message was later deleted because it somehow relates to the testimony that they're going to be providing at trial. It's an absurd result, and it cannot stand. And it also shows that the fault in the reasoning there. So the government believes that the military judge was absolutely off the mark and erroneous when he reached the decision and the conclusion that the United States government violated Article 46, RCM 703, and the Jenks Act.
Well, it's clearly not good practice by the government in this case in the way they handled the beginning of this investigation. So basically you're wanting to give a pass to the investigators for not doing their job that will potentially hurt the defense in this case.
And, Your Honor, with regard to that, are you referring to the Article 46 analysis, RCM 703?
I'm just talking in general. I mean, there was evidence of a sexual assault. I believe it took down at, it was Lackland. So there's obviously, I mean, just putting a little reality back into this situation. Obviously, the folks down at Lackland are quite aware of all the things that are going on. And for an experienced security forces member to just, and in her gut, know she should have taken it to get bad advice from her supervisor on evidence of an ongoing potential sexual assault, seems a little odd to me that you didn't want to say, but no harm, no foul, to the defense when they want to be able to say this evidence may become important to our case.
Yes,
it's really the government off the hook is what it's doing.
Well, Your Honor, I think it is important to think about going back to the, and I know I talked about this before, but the nature of the evidence at issue here was, in the government's position, much more inculpatory than anything exculpatory about it. So if the government investigator fails to utilize a particular investigative technique, that's only putting their own case at risk, not the anything towards the defense or the accused in this case. So it's in the government's best interest to take measures to preserve evidence so that they can secure a conviction. But, and that's exactly what the situation was here. Sergeant Broadway and Officer Denias both recognized evidentiary value in the phone, and it's pretty clear that they were referring to their own case when talking about the evidentiary value, which, under the Article 46 analysis, cuts against the exculpatory nature of the phone.
I have one question, if I may. The defense submitted a discovery request on 27 February requesting, among other things, the production of the contents of all statements, oral or written, made by the accused that are relevant to this case. According to Erin E.H., her daughter lost the phone approximately 2 weeks before the Article 32 hearing, which took place on 28 March. So rough math is roughly 2 weeks passed in between the time of the defense discovery request and the time the phone was lost. The government knew the text messages were out there because Erin E.H. referred to them in her statement in her 1168 that night. Should the government's failure to timely respond to the discovery request be considered in determining whether the government acted in bad faith?
Well, Your Honor, to get to kind of the heart of that question, the statements were handed over to the defense in response to the discovery request. The Sergeant Broadway actually herself had Airman E.H. fill out in 1168 when these things were also discussed, but Sergeant Broadway herself also wrote down and reduced to writing on an 1168 form her steps that she took that night, and included within that 1168 is a reference, an almost verbatim, word-for-word discussion of the text messages that she viewed, and she wrote those down on an 1168. So that content was all handed over to the defense in a timely fashion, and there's nothing on the record to suggest that the defense or that the government or the prosecution in this case did not provide a timely response to that request.
But the government did not secure the cell phone itself. Should the failure to secure the cell phone within that roughly two-week period be a factor we should look at in determining whether the government acted in bad faith?
No, Your Honor. I don't think that would be helpful to the court to be considering. However, if the court does consider it, I think the immediate steps taken by Sergeant Broadway are much bigger factors to consider rather than any steps that may or may not have been taken by the government with regard to Airman E.H.'s personal cell phone.
Should the government have secured the cell phone? I mean, wouldn't that have been a responsive act to the discovery request?
Well, that certainly could have been a strategic choice that the prosecution or investigators. It may have been a best practice to go out and do that. However, I think being as that's not really an issue that was put on the record that they did not take that step, I think it's fair to
to say that that's not necessarily a helpful hypothetical for this court to be considering at this point.
I'd like to
thank you, Your Honor.
I'd like to thank both sides for their very informative argument. We will take this matter under advisement and we'll release a decision in due course. We are adjourned.
All rise.